with this gas with which this mine is filled is also highly explosive. So I strike this match, these cannons will be blown to kingdom come.
And blow yourself up with it?
If I have that power enough, yes, that's just what I'll do.
I advise you to put that match away.
Oh, no.
I am holding a revolver which is aimed at your head. You make one move, strike a light. I'll fire. That seems to amuse you.
You must think I'm pretty stupid. You know as well as I do that a pistol shot would ignite this gas as quickly as my match.
Well, if that stops you.
Have you anything to say?
Maybe the gas has got it. Maybe we'll see it.
Yes, we could. Take off.
I'll just relieve you of those matches.
What's the matter, Bart? Shadow. Look for matches.
Now I demand you open that door. Let those young men out.
Oh, no. Come on, Bart. We're leaving here.
Look out, Bart. I'll help you. It's gassy. He's come through. He's got a pickaxe. You had that coming to you. I told you about it.
Come on.
Keep away from the captain. Put down my axe. And you too, Professor Morley.
Professor Morley? You mean...
Yeah, that's who the boss really is.
I see. That ties in with the disappearance of those boys. How did all this come about?
Morley discovered this mine a year ago. He and Bronson planned the kidnapping of those boys. They had to get labor secretly, or the owners of the cabin would have found out about the ruby.
I see.
I've hated my part in this thing from the beginning. And now that it's over, I'm not sorry I killed them both.
Yours has been a crime of violence, Gatman. But the law will be lenient. They deserve to die. Now, open that door. And we'll lead these young men out of their living death into freedom and life.
Are you weary of listening to Uncle's tired old war stories? Had enough of Zuzu's quest for father's favor? Do you want to hear tales worthy of the Fire Nation princess herself? Then tune in to Scald's Hall on CITR 101.9 FM and listen to the very best established and upcoming storytellers in the land. Do it, peasant, for your princess commands you.
Join us Fridays at 1 p.m. for the best in spoken word entertainment.
Ty Lee, you're not thinking of changing the dial, are you? That's better.
And welcome back to us live at CITR 101.9 FM. We're coming up on noon here in Vancouver, and we're going to be listening to our news broadcast. The news broadcast slot that we have at 5 o'clock for Fridays is going to play host to a documentary that we're going to broadcast. And so in lieu of that, we're going to be talking about the news in just a moment. They're going to be talking about the teacher strike. And as I said, as somebody who's a licensed teacher in the province of BC, this is a pretty big deal. The teacher strike that's going on has its immediate roots in a labor dispute that began 3 years ago. So this has been going on for a long time now. It's affecting the futures of teachers, of parents, of children, of administrators, and of people who are thinking of becoming teachers. And so this is a pretty big deal. And we're going to be talking about that and other news stories coming up in just a moment here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective. News 101 is Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced student and community newscast, bringing you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective. Tune in Mondays and Fridays at 5 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Live streaming and podcasts are available online at citr.ca.
Hijack you a ride on a rocket ship. Hang out with some constellations. Get yourself some isolation, babe. If you need time, here's a clock. You can sit alone at night and listen to it tick and talk. If it stops, wind it up. I'll be somewhere giving up on you. Wasted on nothing but heartache in my chest. You know how much I hate it, baby. You're the one who does it best. Love shouldn't be so hard. Love shouldn't be so hard. Hard as
right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, the 30th of May. I'm Lucy Chen.
And I'm Rohit Joseph. You're listening to a special broadcast of News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good afternoon. It's 12:05 p.m. and today is full hour of independent campus, local, and international news. Today's top segment is our science and technology correspondent, Marco, who will be in live studio with us this week.
We also have a piece produced by CITR's art intern, Seher Asaf, on the ongoing BC Teachers Union strike.
Later in the program, a live interview hosted by Morgan Yee with UBC's Dr. John Olfi about a new arts exhibition called Man Up Against Suicide. And Nina Kirja interviews with Sarah Joe, who worked with WevWev Rape Crisis Center, discussing the recent Santa Barbara shooting by Elliot Rogers.
But first, some headlines for today.
In campus news, the AMS has struck down a proposal to put slides in the new student union building over insurance concerns, according to the UBC. AMS VP Admin Ava Nasri has been quoted as saying the decision came down to student safety taking precedent over the slides. The AMS said that they would consider other options for making the sub more fun.
In local news, the fight between the BC Teachers Federation and the provincial government has been slowly escalating over the last few weeks. Since starting rotating strikes on Monday, the BCTF has been dealt a 10% pay cut in response to decreased working hours during breaks and after classes. The BCTF has challenged the pay cut at the Labor Relations Board, but is expected to have to wait until Wednesday for an official ruling. These recent spats follow weeks of stagnating negotiations between the BCTF and the government over the signing of a new contract between the two parties. Conflict has been primarily centered on issues of classroom size and composition, as well as pay structure. The BCTF has been unwavering in calling for a short-term, four-year contract, even after the government reduced their original proposal for a contract from 10 years to 6. The government has offered a $1,200 signing bonus if a compromise is made by the end of the school year.
In national news, the National Post has named Anne Mary Owens its new editor-in-chief. Owens is the first woman to hold a top editorial job at the Canadian National Newspaper, a triumph long overdue in the media industry. Owens is deeply rooted in the paper, having served as the former news editor. She was originally a national reporter for the paper when it first launched in 1998. More recently, Owens oversaw the redesign of Maclean's online and tablet issues. Her tech-savvy candor will be an asset at a time when newspapers are struggling with falling advertising revenues, shrinking readerships, and challenging integrating into a multimedia environment. She takes her position in the Post on June 9th.
And in international news, Russia and China vetoed a UN Security Council resolution which would have empowered the World Tribunal to press charges for war crimes committed in Syria. United Nations Deputy Secretary General Jan Eliasson commented on the decision, stating, quote, "If members of the Council continue to be unable to agree on a measure that could provide some accountability for the ongoing crimes, the credibility of this body and the entire organization will continue to suffer," end quote. French ambassador to the United Nations, Gerard Araud, described China's and Russia's decision akin to vetoing justice. A war that has seen as many atrocities and crimes against humanity as Syria's might have seemed immune to political squabbling, but many critics have claimed this latest failure is a sign that the members of the Security Council are incapable of diplomacy. Unfortunately, the veto from China and Russia will be seen by many as an effort to complicate, or perhaps even sabotage, the resolution that sought justice for innocents murdered and brutalized at the hands of a merciless regime.
Last week, Thailand's military staged a coup in an attempt to stabilize the country's polarized social fractions. The divide between the nation's elite and the working class has been turbulent over the last few months, with protesters on each side of the conflict occupying buildings and government offices. The recent coup was seen as a victory for the elites in Thailand, who had grown disillusioned with the model of popular democracy and sought to diminish the electoral power of the working class, who elected the previous Prime Minister, Thaksin Shinawatra. On the other hand, the Thai military refused to lean in a particular political direction and maintained the coup was only to seek a compromise between the elite and the workers. Unfortunately, the military coup seemed to be only a marked transition in the turbulence, as an anti-coup demonstrated broke out and continued to spread. Yesterday, more than 1,000 Thai soldiers and police officers sealed off one of Bangkok's busiest intersections to prevent a planned protest. Authorities said that they would no longer allow any demonstrations against the coup. The U.S. State Department, a longtime ally of Thailand, has called for the Thai military to, quote, facilitate an inclusive and transparent electoral process, end quote. The Thai Army's Deputy Chief of Staff has responded by saying that it would be inappropriate to hold elections in the wake of the anti-coup protests. At a press conference, he stated, quote, it is the military council's intentions to create the right conditions to put Thailand into path to free and fair elections, end quote.
Those are your UBC campus, local, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned.
My name is David Scott. I play wide receiver for the University of British Columbia football team, and I'm here to discuss the Be More Than a Bystander program. Myself and a few other players were lucky enough to work alongside the BC Lions and EVA, the Ending Violence Association, to support this cause. The main goal of the Be More Than a Bystander initiative is to increase awareness of domestic violence against women. For more information on the cause, please visit endingviolence.org.
Imagine being 16 years old and setting sail to crew on a boat bound for the Northwest Passage. And then your boat falls victim to the unforgiving Arctic. You're separated from your crewmates and you're on your own for 70 years. Meet William Crayford, the teller of that tale, on Saturday, May 31 at the Vancouver Maritime Museum for a special ceremony, Raise the Sails and Ring the Bell, honoring his incredible story of survival. Raise the Sails and Ring the Bell is a free full-day family celebration featuring photo ops with real-life Mountie and RCMP patrol boat, the once-in-a-lifetime hoisting of the mainsail of Crayford's vessel, the St. Roch, and much more. Visit VancouverMaritimeMuseum.com or call 604-257-8300 to learn more about the story of William Crayford and the celebration on May 31.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have our weekly science and technology segment with Marco.
Today, we're going to be talking about Space Holiday with Leonardo DiCaprio, meat grown in the lab, cancer scare in Canada, two pieces on girl power, and a new iron suit for the U.S. military. In the first news, how would you like to take a trip to space with Leonardo DiCaprio? Well, someone will. In a conference or in a fundraising event last week, it was called AMFAR Auction near Cannes, France, which benefits AIDS. There was a bidding for a trip to space with Leonardo DiCaprio. The winning bid went for 700,000 euros, or about $954,000. The winner will board the Virgin Galactic suborbital spaceship with Leonardo and four other passengers, be brought up to the upper atmosphere by another plane and then be released. Then the Virgin Galactic suborbital Spaceship 2 will fire its rockets and will do some orbits of Earth. And the lucky winner will be sitting next to Leo on this trip. Usual seats for this flight will be going in the $250,000 range. But if you want to fly with somebody like Ashton Kutcher, Angelina Jolie, or Justin Bieber, they're planning to go up. So if you have a $1 million, you can go up with them. Another company called Xcor Aerospace is trying to sell seat aboard its one-passenger Lynx rocket plane for $95,000. In other news, CBC ran a story this week that skin cancer is now the most prevalent form of cancer in Canada. This is particularly troubling because many young people can take precautions like wearing sunscreen, hats, or glasses, but they are not. A higher risk of contracting the most deadliest form of skin cancer, melanoma, will occur if tanning booths are used. That's why four or five provinces in Canada, like BC, have passed legislation to come up to a minimum age in order to do tanning. In other news, a robot furniture that rearranges itself is now on the market. Like it's seen out of the Jetsons, cartoon, robotic block furniture that resemble Lego and assemble themselves into different configurations is now on the market. A group of scientists in Switzerland has developed small robotic modules called Roombots, which fit together like Lego blocks to form structures that can self-assemble and morph into different shapes. This type of furniture will be particularly handy to elderly or disabled passengers. For example, they can fashion a stool that can follow them around the room, and in case they need to sit down quickly, the little Roombot will be there to help them. The Roombot is a completely independent unit, about 9 inches long. It has a battery, a small motor, and a set of retractable claws that can hook onto other Roombots to create bigger structures. There's no word yet if this is available yet in Canada. Now turning to girl power. The White House Science Fair turned spotlights on girls. Last week, President Obama hosted his fourth annual Science Fair for Girls. It was held on Tuesday, May 27th, and it focused specifically on girls and women in STEM. The acronym STEM stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. President Obama, since day one, has been committed to getting more underrepresented groups, including women and girls, excited in the sciences. Obama started the White House Science Fair in 2009, and he launched his Educate to Innovate campaign, ETI, to inspire kids in math and science. Previous White House Science Fair have featured everything from marshmallow launchers to robots. Last year's convention honored 100 students from more than 40 states. Bill Nye the Science Guy and actor LeVar Burton were on hand to make special appearances. The U.S. military has invented a new Iron Man suit prototype, which has debuted this month. The Iron Man suit, a robotic exoskeleton, is designed to augment human abilities on the battlefield. A prototype of the Tactical Assault Light Operator, Talos, will be available later this month, and a more complete version should be ready between 2016 to 2018. The suit works to protect troops in combat, to give them better armor, better protection, better communication, and provides things such as robotic underwater vehicles, digital head-up displays, and also de-icing aircraft machines. These technologies were shown at a Special Forces Industry Conference held on May 20 to 22nd in Tampa Bay, Florida. The Talos has a bronze coating, and it was inspired, or the name was inspired from a bull made of bronze that guarded the island of Crete by running around it and throwing stones at invaders. The suit will protect its wearers from bullets. It will assist them in lifting heavy loads and will provide with camera sensors and other advanced displays. Do you think you're ready for lab-grown meats? Scientists have now said that they can grow meats in the lab, and there's going to be the ick factor that, isn't it? Will people be ready to eat meat that is grown in the lab? So scientists have now grown meat labs from stem cells in a factory. The technology now exists, and it represents a greener and more ethical form of production compared to current method. If people can accept the idea of eating lab-grown meat, this will be the biggest hurdle. So as large parts of the world become more prosperous, the global consumption of meat is going to rise drastically. The current methods of meat production is unsustainable. It consumes vast amounts of energy, pollutes the environment, and causes a lot of animal suffer. Although there are vegetarian sources of protein available, global meat consumption can only be expected to grow in the future. So is growing meat in a lab feasible? Yes, it is. Scientists have done it by taking cells from, or stem cells from animals and cultivating them in a nutrient-rich soup inside a bioreactor. And these cells can then be grown increasingly in large containers and formed into cakes. But again, it's the ick factor. Will people accept these eating lab-grown meats? We'll have to wait because they're coming to us now. On another story, the FBI loosens its marijuana rules. So why has it done that? Because it cannot attract enough hackers. So the FBI, in an effort to attract more computer hackers, have decided they will loosen their rules on smoking marijuana. FBI Director James B. Comey last Monday said the agency is grappling with the idea of loosening restrictions against marijuana smoking because it is simply too hard to attract top-notch computer hackers otherwise. The agency needs to fill more than 2,000 jobs in its cybercrime unit, but it is having trouble luring talented applicants, according to the International Business Times. According to James B. Comey, the FBI director, I have to hire a great workforce to compete, with cyber criminals, and some of these kids want to smoke weed on the way to the interview, Comey told the New York City Bar Association. So originally, Comey was dead set against the youth, dead set against marijuana smoking, and previously he said he would not reverse the ban on hiring drug users, but it seems he has now changed his mind. On one last story, a spacecraft is now orbiting the Saturn's moon of Titan. Titan is the largest moon in Saturn, the second largest in the solar system. They're studying the moon in order to develop technologies to study exoplanets and exomoons. These are planets and moons that are outside of our solar system. So this is another mission of the Cassini spacecraft. You have been listening to Science and Technology News with Marco.
Thank you, Marco. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM.
GOSA, the Global Outreach Students Association, offers students the chance to learn about global health and international development while providing students with opportunities for practical experience working within disadvantaged communities both locally and internationally. They also collaborate with other clubs to organize global health-related symposiums and competitions. Executive positions are available. Contact them at ubc.gosa@gmail.com.
I'm gonna be around my vegetables.
Sprouts, you've ate here before. Community Eats is back for the summer.
We are your local food co-op.
We are your volunteer opportunity.
We are your meeting place.
We are your nutritious Friday lunch.
We are sustainability.
We are community.
Eats every Friday.
Come by with a reusable container, donate, and tell us what community means to you. Friday, 11:30 to 3 p.m. Food, fun, friends.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have a piece produced by CITR's art intern, Seher Asaf, on the ongoing BC Teachers Union Strike.
As you may have heard, the BC Teachers Federation has been on strike in an effort to demand higher wages and a limit on class sizes. Federation President Jim Eicher has confirmed that BC teachers will continue rotating one-day strikes next week on Monday, Tuesday, and Friday. Throughout the week, a total of 41,000 teachers within BC have carried out rotating strikes, impacting all districts in the province. Eicher said, quote, BC teachers are committed to negotiating a fair and reasonable settlement at the bargaining table. Education Minister Peter Fassbender told reporters at the Legislature on Wednesday that he was, quote, profoundly disappointed that while we're still at the table with all of the talk that's been going on, that children and parents and communities are continuing to be held hostage and put in the middle of this dispute, unquote. Eicher also said, quote, that agreement, however, needs to include adequate funding to make improvements to important learning conditions, which are teachers' working conditions. It's time for Premier Christy Clark to free up the resources that will bring the two sides closer together and ensure students start the next school year with smaller classes, more support for children with special needs, and extra one-on-one time, unquote. All public schools in BC will be behind picket lines for one day this week as part of the second stage of their job action. A partial lockout against teachers was initiated by the teachers' employers last week, and negotiators from the BC government responded by ordering a lockout and a pay cut for teachers participating in the job action. On Tuesday, May 27th, I had a chance to talk to high school students on their views on the strike.
Personally, I heard a lot of things from both the teacher side, and I read a lot of information that the government provided. It was difficult for me to make a decision which side to stand on, but I personally think that the strike does affect our education. It suspended one day of class, which is important because classes are going to end in June and there are a lot of finals and stuff, and missing one day of class at this moment is very crucial is a sad loss for a student.
They have a right to strike, so they should go on strike, but it does affect our education badly. But like, if they're feeling that they're being unfairly treated, then they should go on strike.
I think it's logical because like, the government has been cutting a lot of funding, and it's really difficult for teachers to have like extracurricular activities with such a low pay. And yeah, I support the strike in all hearts. I was just trying to use the gym facility at school, and they said I couldn't because there was no one to supervise, so I had to just go.
Yeah. I don't really care because I got one free day, and it's like finals are coming, so we need time, like available time to review. Yeah, I don't really care whether, just like depends on date, because like there's one day I got the chemistry and math, and there's one day I got like all three blocks, so yeah, I don't really care. It doesn't really affect me.
Does it affect you? And what about you?
It doesn't affect me at all. I think I can get a free block for a whole day. Like, it's awesome.
Okay, great. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Seher. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
What kind of city?
Are you not sure where to go on campus? Traveling late at night and afraid to go alone? Call SafeWalk, a free service where a co-ed team will take you anywhere you need to go on campus. Don't walk alone. For a walk, add SafeWalk to your phone. Call 604-822-5355. That's 604-822-5355. Alternatively, use a UBC Blue phone and ask for SafeWalk. Approach any SafeWalk team or drop by our office on the main floor of the sub across from the gallery lounge.
Because you're mine, I walk the line.
The question, what kind of cities do we want to live in? How do we want our cities to be? Cannot be divorced from the question of what kind of people we want to be.
Join me, your host, Andrew Longhurst, every Tuesday at 5 p.m. for The City, an hour dedicated to critical discussions of urban issues. Live on CITR 101.9 FM and CITR.ca. For more info, visit thecityfm.org.
The AMS Sexual Assault Support Center is happy to present its new collaboration with My Sister's Closet, a social enterprise of battered women support services. The SASC's Got Consent clothing items will be sold at My Sister's Closet, located at 1092 Seymour Street in Vancouver. The Got Consent initiative is a preventative campaign that creatively touches upon the necessity for consent to be present during all sexual encounters. The Got Consent branding is visible on a variety of clothing items, including t-shirts, underwear, and tank tops. It's also available at the SASC and the UBC Wellness Center in the sub, in addition to at My Sister's Closet. For more information on the Sexual Assault Support Center at UBC and the Got Consent campaign, go to ams.ubc.ca/SASC.
We be
A Jihad for Love, Whitewater Black Gold, A Red Girl's Guide to Reasoning, East Hastings Pharmacy, Ai Weiwei Never Sorry, Misrepresentation.
Cinema Politica UBC screens politically charged films with speakers and discussions every month. Screenings take place at the Norm Theater in the sub and are by donation. To learn more, visit cinemapolitica.org/UBC.
This is Morgan Yee. I'm here in studio for News 101, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia. And today I'll be speaking with Dr. John Olive. He's a professor at UBC, and he's been involved with a new art exhibition called Man Up Against Suicide. John, can you hear me?
Yes, Morgan. Thanks for having me.
Perfect. So I guess the first thing that I would like to ask you to tell us a little bit about is what exactly Man Up Against Suicide is.
Sure. So Movember funded the Men's Depression and Suicide Network, and it's composed of five projects. And one of those projects is the Man Up Against Suicide project. So just to say that this is an arts-based project. So what we do is we recruit people who have lost a man to suicide. We also recruited men who'd had experiences with suicidal thoughts, plus or minus suicide attempts. And we invited them to take photographs about their experiences. And then we interview them about those photographs that they've taken, and then we help them to produce a photograph from their collection along with the captions. Mm-hmm. And they're being exhibited at the Foster Eastman studio for the month of June.
Okay, and this project launched, correct me if I'm wrong, it's this past Wednesday, May 28th?
Yeah, we had over 300 guests at the launch of the exhibition. It was so well attended, and it was a very powerful evening. We had 15 of the 25 participants who had their work on show were able to join us for the event. And we had lots of people. We had people from UBC, we had researchers, we had service providers in terms of crisis counselling service providers, we had artists. There was just so many different types of people at the launch. It was a very powerful and terrific night.
And what kind of responses were you getting from the people who attended?
Yeah, it's interesting. Mixed, you know, like there's the photographs. Some of the photographs they deal with expressions around grief and loss. Some of the photographs are more around hope and providing alternatives and suggestions and for alternatives to taking one's life. You know, so there's very different pieces there, and so of course, you know, depending on which piece you were interacting with. You know, your reactions would, you know, correspond, you know, perhaps with that particular image and its message. And of course, with art, you know, there's so much room for interpretation and, mm-hmm. and people see things differently. And that's part of the beauty of the exhibition. So I guess I'd say that, the overall it was very, very positive that we're breaking the silence around male suicide and we're getting a conversation. And mm-hmm. it's very positive in that way. And there were people, who certainly, you know, I wouldn't say upset, I'd say, were really feeling some of the power of those pieces, so and articulating it in good ways. You know, there was lots of people on hand to chat and talk through the pieces, and I think it worked well.
Now, recently in the news, there was on CBC they were doing a profile on the 9/11 museum that's in New York City. Did you feel like you were getting any responses that were, like, sort of, you know, we don't want our grief being on display for everyone else?
The participants were, the participants were very, very involved. So, you know, they had the choice of what was shown.
Okay.
It was very clear about what was going to be shown from their pictures. Some of the participants actually worked with Foster Eastman to develop their pieces as well. So there's a couple of pieces that are done in layers where he'd actually run kind of art classes with 9 participants to produce different pieces.
Okay.
So, you know, they were very hands-on, and there's three participants who worked with him to produce 3-dimensional art pieces that kind of, you know, jut into the space of the gallery, and they were very hands-on as well. And so, you know, people had a very clear sense of what was going to be in the space, what was going to be shown. And of course, you can be anonymous. Many of the participants were there; they weren't necessarily standing next to their piece explaining it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was room for anonymity, of course. You know, and the comfort of those people, you know, and their willingness to share, you know, implicitly or explicitly.
Exactly. Now, you had mentioned that there were about 25 participants?
So, yeah, in total, this exhibition features the first 25 participants. We've continued to do interviews with other participants. We've currently done 36, where
okay.
we are going to continue to include participants. We're still recruiting. We're always interested in talking to people about their experiences, and we will run for as long as we possibly can in terms of bringing people in to share their perspectives, to get as many voices into this conversation as we can. The actual exhibition is going to travel across the country. We're in Winnipeg next year, Montreal the year after. I'm taking a dozen of the photographs through to a conference, a men's health conference in Leeds, in England, in July. So this is where we're wanting to evolve the collection. We're wanting to keep it fresh and keep it moving. And so, of course, we're still recruiting.
And does that mean you're also recruiting from people outside of the Lower Mainland?
Yeah. So the idea would be that we've been inundated with people who want to participate in the study. It seems like it seems like many, many people have been touched by male suicide and have a story to tell. And we think that's really important, you know, to try and facilitate that conversation. So absolutely, as we go into Winnipeg, you know, we will be showing the exhibition, but we'll also be recruiting in and around Winnipeg. We've got some interviews scheduled for Toronto. We're also going to Calgary. You know, we've had some people contact us. So we are travelling and definitely including different perspectives. We're also very keen to get into rural and remote British Columbia
right.
To sort of to, you know, again, travel the exhibition, but also, you know, we're interested in hearing some of the stories from other parts of the country.
Yeah. Well, I'm actually from a small community up north that's quite remote, and there is a lot of male self-suicide and male mental health issues
yes.
that often go unnoticed. So I guess then turning from the exhibition to the bigger issue at hand, what factors do you feel are contributing to the stifling and stigma around male emotiveness and male mental illness in today's society?
Well, I think, you know, I think the stigma prevails around suicide, I think, across men and women. I think what's troubling, particularly troubling about male suicide is, you know, for us, as researchers and things like that, the thing that got me interested in this area was I was looking at the depression statistics around men, and men are diagnosed at half the rate of women with depression, yet they suicide at four times the rate of mm-hmm. women. Now, I'm not suggesting that the only route to suicide is depression, but my suggestion is the relationship is discordant in men's depression and suicide. So I said another way, simply that I don't think we're picking up enough depression in men,
mm-hmm.
and I think it's becoming severe for men, and they're not necessarily seeking help or plus or minus soliciting help or getting the help they need.
Yeah.
And so in some ways it's trying to unpack, you know, that piece and trying to better understand, you know, those pathways towards getting help so as we can get into some suicide prevention. The stigma around it is that, you know, some people would suggest that it's a form of giving up. You know, mm-hmm. some people would judge it as a cowardly act. And, you know, and I think in families it's oftentimes the ones who are left, the survivors of suicide, it's hard to talk about because it can be perceived as a deficit within the family, whether that's moral, religious, you know, a whole bunch of connotations go with it. And I think it very easily troubles people, and it's difficult to talk about because, you know, it just seems so amenable to intervention. It just seems like something we should be able to prevent. And there's often, you know, in our experience of talking to people, survivors of male suicide, you know, there's often just extreme uncertainty about how come, you know, like, what didn't I see? You know, I never would have picked this. I just didn't see this coming. All of those sorts of things. So, you know, I think it's shock that shuts us down and stigmatizes something too, and silence is an issue. So it's a variety of things.
Okay. Now, do you feel that this problem is confined to, you know, Western cultures, or does this span across cultural differences?
Yeah, you know, it is interesting because in some Asian countries, you know, the gender split on suicide actually is the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So more women than men suicide. So when we talk about men's suicide being greater than in numbers, we're talking about Western men. So I think that's a kind of good point. And I also think that, you know, the stigma, I think probably in some countries and some cultures, so you could be an immigrant carrying, you know, bicultural kind of values and things.
Mm-hmm.
I think that some of those prescriptive kind of pieces or cultural norms can really shut down the conversations in particular pockets and cultures. And so I think it is different in different places. You know, you mentioned being from up north and small communities. You know, sometimes those communities really, you know, they might have a conversation or it might be very taboo. You know, it might be even more taboo. So I think it varies by place, varies by culture, you know. But I think the stigma still prevails. And we're really trying hard to break that silence in ways that doesn't sensationalise it but really gets an authentic conversation about, you know, we need to really thoughtfully consider suicide prevention strategies.
And what kind of prevention strategies did come up through this project?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So we know that in men, one of the major issues and one of the biggest risk factors is that when they self-isolate or become quite socially isolated, that's one of the biggest risk factors. So I'm not suggesting this is a simple suicide prevention piece, but many of the programs that are available to men are actually community-based programs that connect men with other people.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, one of the programs, the projects that we're doing with the Men's Depression and Suicide Network is we're trying to replicate the men's sheds movement within Canada. So sheds have worked quite well in other countries, where we bring in older men who might not necessarily have work, and they come into a space of doing different activities and they connect with other men. It's the social connectedness that helps them. So it's kind of like one example of how you can kind of foster social connectedness for guys who might be, you know, vulnerable to being, ostracized, or who might be self-isolating because of issues around mental illness. So there's a bunch of those different programs. Another one downtown east side is the Dudes Club, and that's another project that's running underneath the Men's Depression and Suicide Network.
Okay.
And, you know, that attracts a lot of First Nations men downtown east side. Mm-hmm. Some of them grappling with homelessness, mental illness, and brings them into a space where they can have a bite to eat and connect with other men. And also, it's a great forum for us to talk about different health issues, you know, so we give them a little bit of health information along the way with that. So, you know, there's a few ideas about how to try and, you know, intervene mm-hmm. in ways that are community-based.
That are actually meaningful.
Yeah, absolutely.
My last question for you would be, in terms of media coverage, how would you like to see issues surrounding male mental health covered?
Well, that's a great question. I'd like authentic conversations. I'd like us to be able to talk about, you know, male suicide in ways that that put forward the stories of these men. And some of the things that we could help to adjust, that would be great, you know, because I see the murder suicide ones, you know, stories they feature quite prominently,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I don't, you know, I mean, I understand it's newsworthy, but I think there's other ways of broaching the topic, you know, and trying to think about it in proactive ways.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much, Professor.
Yeah, thanks, Morgan.
It was great having you on air, and hopefully we will hear more about male mental health from you in the future.
For sure. Thanks so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care.
And that was John Olive. He's a doctor and professor here at UBC. We're going to take a quick PSA break, and we'll be right back to you with more News 101.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
Up next on the program, we have Nina Kirigia's interview with Sarah Joe, who works with the WAVAW Rape Crisis Center, discussing the recent Santa Barbara shootings by Elliot Rogers.
Last Friday, 22-year-old college student Elliot Rogers shot and killed 6 people in Santa Barbara, California. In a YouTube explanation of his violence, Rogers stated that his reason for going on a mass murder spree was to seek revenge from girls he felt should have gone out with him, and were the reason he was still a virgin. Many have seen his violent rampage as a direct link to the entitlement present in society among men and women, particularly that men should have the right of sex from women without mutual affection and understanding. I spoke to Sarah Joe from Women Against Violence Against Women, which is also known as WAVA. WAVA is a rape crisis center that works to end all forms of violence against women, and they have over 30 years' experience in battling violence against women. Sarah is assistant coordinator at the Care About Gender Violence Project at WAVA, which is designed to focus on a partnership with Vancouver Community College to create a campus action plan that will address gender-based violence. Here is what Sarah had to say about the role of misogyny in this horrific shooting.
Yes, I absolutely agree that misogyny had a role in this shooting because by definition, misogyny is the hatred of women. And in this case, his hatred of women and his sense of superiority over women because of their supposed low status and worth was what was the driving force. And so it was so angering to him that these people who he deems as subhuman would not reciprocate his desires, or even worse, that they did not worship him as a superior human being. And so misogyny played a huge role in the actions that were taken, absolutely.
Yeah, and once we've sort of established that and that how he's saying he's an alpha male and he's going to show his true alpha male spirit through the shootings, can this be described as a hate crime against women?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think at the root of this misogyny is really about power, and it's about the powerlessness that he felt over his own situation. And so he is being taught at a young age and all around him that he's entitled to women and that women should be subservient to him and that they should be, you know, vying for his affection. And when that doesn't happen, he feels like he has been screwed out of something that he's been owed. And so at this point, he's not even seeing women as people who deserve respect or that there needs to be a mutual love or desire in this relationship. It's that he is owed these women and he's not getting them. And that to him seems like an absolutely unfair proposition.
Exactly. And then there were a bunch of people on social media responding by saying, oh, well, you know, he was rich, he could have hired a prostitute, and all these things like, well, that could have quote-unquote fixed his problem, like as if this was a problem. And what is the problem with thinking like that?
Well, the problem with thinking like that is there are many problems, but the first is that the responsibility is on women. So women were supposed to have cured him of his misogyny. And the emphasis on sex is really easy to make because it distracts us from the larger societal issues that a real power imbalance exists between men and all other genders. And so, and really, when you get to it, the point isn't that he just wanted sex. He wanted to eradicate women and see the world kind of quote-unquote cleansed of this lesser species. And so if this was really about sex, there are so many creative ways that people find sexual pleasure without the help of a co-player.
Exactly.
And these methods are easily available online. And that just, again, puts the burden of sexual assault and violence on women. And it puts women as the people who are supposed to be saving themselves. And, you know, by differentiating these sex workers from other women, it implies that these sex workers are deserving of someone as violent as him and that they don't deserve any rights or protections from someone like him. So they're just implying that, you know, so really what do sex workers become? They become quote-unquote just collateral damage in the effort to, you know, save other more deserving women from his wrath. That is basically the heart of misogyny too. What those types of comments basically imply is that a woman's consent and choice does not matter, and that men are entitled to women and can inherently claim ownership over them. And women are not responsible for fulfilling anyone's sexual desires but our own. Contrary to what society may want us to think, women do have agency and autonomy to choose who we engage in relationships with. And again, this whole conversation puts the responsibility of preventing violence against women on women and totally absolves the role of men and society in this situation.
I was going to ask you what we can learn from this tragedy and further from that, ways looking at this, ways that we in our everyday lives can sort of stop this way of thinking
Yeah, well, I think we can learn a few things. The first is that someone who had extremely violent, misogynistic beliefs found tremendous support and sympathy before and after the massacre and felt empowered to make the decision that he did. And so there were people who found his actions understandable and sympathetic and shifted the responsibility onto women. And if that is the first mainstream response that we get, then I think that we see that we have a long ways to go. And we need to work on creating cultures of respect and dismantling and challenging patriarchy. And so I just want to give one concrete example because it has to do with a post-secondary campus here in Vancouver. And I know when people want to talk about, you know, shifting culture or what can we do, a lot of it happens to stay in the big picture. But in order to bring it to the ground and into our community, I wanted to share this example, and it is a partnership between WAVA and Vancouver Community College, and it's called the Care About Gendered Violence Project, and it's an anti-violence initiative that is creating an action plan to really provide education and prevention, but also meaningfully support and center survivors of sexual assault. And so post-secondary campuses must prioritize the safety and well-being of female students.